Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our good friend, John Feinstein, is in town just coincidentally to promote his new book, A Season on the Brink. He is the author of 35 books, including A Season on the Brink and A Good Walk Spoiled. And we're here to talk to him about his brand new book, which is about three people whom we really like. It's called The Legends Club, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and the an epic college basketball rivalry. John, I'm so sorry. I'm so nervous. I mean, you're a hero.
I don't know why you're nervous, DG, but it's good to be with you.
You've got lots of fans here because of your other sports books. We like you because you're interested in North Carolina, North Carolina State, and Duke, and you brought those three programs together in a – would you? It's not really a biography of the three coaches. What do you call it?
Well, it's a chronicle of three remarkable men who happened to be in basically in the same place for 10 years in the 1980s. Dean, obviously, coaching at Carolina, Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, Jim Valvano at NC State. Valvano and Krzyzewski arrived in North Carolina 9 days apart.
What day was that?
March 18th, Krzyzewski was hired at Duke, and March 27th, Valvano was hired.
In 1980.
And Mike's line on that is that if he and Jim had landed from Mars instead of from New York, because Mike was coaching at Army and Jim was coaching at Iona in Westchester County outside New York City, rather than New York, they could not have been less aware of what an iconic figure Dean Smith was in the state of North Carolina. And it took a little while for them to completely understand it. But Mike tells the story that about a year after he got here, he was recruiting a kid in California named Mark Akers. And any coach will tell you there's certain recruiting visits where you know you're not getting the kid. It's just not going well. But he had to go through the routine. And at the end, he turned to Mark Akers' mother and he said, "Mrs. Akers, you haven't asked me any questions at all. Is there anything you want to know about Duke, about our academics, about how Mark would fit in?" And she said, "No, I don't need to ask any questions because the only thing that's important is that Mark go to college somewhere where he'll be close to God." And Mike said, "Well, if he comes to Duke, God will be coaching 10 miles down the road in Chapel Hill, so you might want to consider it." And they both quickly realized what they were up against and took very different approaches. Valvano always approached things with humor. And his line, ironically, tragically, was, "I'll never outcoach Dean Smith, but maybe I can outlive him." And, of course, he didn't. But Mike approached it the way an Army guy trained by Bob Knight might approach it, with hostility. And the two of them were very – Dean and Mike were very antagonistic towards one another for a long time. And the irony is that what changed it was when Mike became a coaching star and ultimately after Dean retired, he became Dean in the ACC. It had always been Dean that everybody wanted to beat, Dean who was the target, Carolina who was the benchmark. And then it became Krzyzewski who played those roles, and he started to feel some of the pressures you feel when you're on top and began to understand better why Dean Smith did some of the things
almost,
that he did.
As you point out at the end of the book, early on, Krzyzewski thought that Dean Smith had the referees bamboozled.
Oh, yeah.
That, and then all of a sudden when Dean was gone and Krzyzewski was sort of the king, he started hearing that the referees were deferring to him.
Correct.
And it was, and as you say, he just really became Dean in
right.
a way.
Yeah, it's something I joked with him about because you remember the famous double standard story in 1984 after Carolina won a close game in Durham, and Mike said there was a double standard, one for Dean with the referees and one for everybody else. Dean was furious about that because he saw it correctly, and Mike feels the same way now, as kind of a put down of his players. Because if you say the referees are giving you the game, then you're not giving the players the proper credit for being as good as they are. And Mike didn't understand that back then.
He understands it better now.
Yeah, he
sure
does.
Well, tell us, your book is full of great stories, and one of the ones that that was important to me was this first end of the game story early on when a little bit of the antagonism developed,
right.
And it showed a side of Dean Smith that we don't remember as well as maybe you.
Well, the thing you have to remember is that Dean, as I said, even though he was more subtle about it, was as competitive as anybody who ever lived. And the first time Dean and Mike coached against each other was in the old Big Four tournament in December of 1980. And it was only Krzyzewski's third game at Duke. And it was a good game, close game, and Carolina was up too late, and Duke missed a shot, ball batted around, went out of bounds, and it was Duke ball, but the clock had run to zero. And, of course, in those days, there's no replay, there's no tenths of a second. And Krzyzewski charged to the scorer's table and started yelling at the clock operator that there should still be at least a second left. This was in the Greensboro Coliseum. And Dean walked over, put out his hand, and said, "Nice game." And Mike turned around, I'll clean it up a little bit, and said, "The damn game's not over yet, Dean." And Dean was kind of taken aback. Roy Williams was standing right behind Dean at that moment. He was Carolina's third assistant back then. And he said when he heard that, his first reaction was, nobody should talk to Coach Smith that way. But his second reaction was, this guy's got some guts for a 33-year-old coach just out of Army. He's not backing down. And Hank Nichols was reffing, and he came over and told Krzyzewski, game's over. So at that point, Krzyzewski turned around and put out his hand, and Dean did kind of a grip and run because he was a little annoyed. And Mike held him and wouldn't let him go and said, at least admit that it was a hell of a game, Dean. You know, he wanted that acknowledgement from the great man. And Dean said, I'm going to remember this. And Mike said, good, I hope you do. And that was the beginning of an unbeautiful friendship.
This was not a parting that got smoothed over very quickly.
No, it took years. I mean, years and years, because as I said, 4 years later came the double standard game, and then there was a game in the ACC tournament that year where Duke finally beat Carolina with the Allery, Billis, Dawkins, Henderson group that turned the program around for Krzyzewski, and that was a huge win for Duke. And what I remember most vividly about that game, you may remember Keith Drum, who lives about a mile down the road from here. He was the sports editor of the Durham Morning Herald.
He wrote an article.
Well, and he had written a column the week before after Carolina beat Duke in Carmichael Auditorium in double overtime. And his lead was the best team was not the winning team in Carmichael Auditorium last night. Now, it's worth remembering, Keith went to Carolina. But he was the one reporter in this state who thought Krzyzewski was going to be a star, who didn't doubt him during those early years. And Dean was fully aware of that. And after Duke won this game, 77-75, a week later in the ACC tournament, Keith's my best friend. We were walking down the steps in the Greensboro Coliseum to the locker room area. And back then, Dean was still smoking. And he was standing outside the locker room smoking a cigarette. And he saw Keith. He walked across the hallway, put his hand out, and said, congratulations, you must be very proud of your team. Now, Keith went to Carolina. I went to Duke, but he's standing there saying congratulations to Keith on Duke winning the game because he was trying to make a point, you know, that Keith had been disloyal.
This is a part of Dean that he could be very sarcastic, I guess.
Sarcastic is the exact word. I mean, every former player, every former assistant coach you talk to would say that was his way of expressing displeasure. He never cursed, but Buzz Peterson tells stories about in practice, they'd be running the offense and Buzz would take a shot and the whistle would blow. And Dean would say, now, Buzz, was that really the best shot we could get on that play? Do you really? Let's ask your teammates. Any of you guys think that was the best shot we could have gotten? Or Eddie Fogler tells stories about if you didn't go after a loose ball, he would blow the whistle and he'd say, Eddie, is that as hard as you can go? Are you okay? Do you need to sit out the rest of practice? And some of the guys said they would have rather that he yelled because the sarcasm made you want to kind of open a hole in the floor and dive through it. And that was the way he expressed his displeasure.
You tell lots of stories, and this story reminded me of the one that you told about Valvano when Wittenberg, I think, was tired. When can I get a rest?
No, it was Sidney Lowe, actually.
Sidney Lowe.
Yeah, they were.
Tell that story.
It was Sidney Lowe's senior year, Derek Wittenberg and Thurl Bailey senior year, too, the year they ended up going on to win the national championship. And they were playing Wake Forest. Wake Forest had a very good team. And Wittenberg was hurt. He was out with a broken foot. And there was no shot clock back then. So Jim basically wanted Sidney to kill the clock the last 3 minutes. They had a lead, not a big one. And Sidney's dribbling around, sort of like Phil Ford in the old days. You know, pass it, give me right back. Dribbling around, pass it, give me right back. Finally, he comes over near the bench, and he's trying to get Valvano's attention. And Valvano won't look at him. And he finally says, Coach, I need a blow. And Valvano says, you'll get one, Sidney, as soon as your eligibility's used up. Because he wasn't coming out of that game.
If you joined us late, we're visiting with John Feinsinger. We're talking about his new book, The Legends Club. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is John Feinstein. He's here in town, back in town, promoting his new book, The Legends Club. And the subtitle is Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and an epic college basketball rivalry. Did you write that title? That's a long title.
I did eventually. Yeah, it is a long title. It's funny because initially I wanted to call the book The Triangle, which makes perfect sense, double entendre, obviously. But my publisher pointed out that some people might think the book was about Phil Jackson, and we certainly didn't want that. So that's when I came up with The Legends Club and wanted all three names in the subtitle for obvious reasons so people would know who the book was about.
Before we took the break, you were telling stories, and I think the one of the stories that captured Valvano as well as any, and his humor and his willing to laugh at anything, was when he came and everybody at State wanted him to beat North Carolina just as quick as anything and didn't happen. And then there was the story about the dog.
About the dog.
Will you tell that story
for
us?
Yeah, and I should say this story, I'm sure, is hyperbolic because Jim occasionally did
that. Well, don't
say
that. I mean,
okay. This actually happened. It is true that the first year Jim was at State, they lost to Carolina twice. And according to Jim, after the second loss in Reynolds Coliseum, an old State alumnus in a red jacket came up to him and said, "Coach, now I understand you're a Yankee and you don't get our rivalries down here, but, you know, we can't be losing the Tar Heels this way." And Jim said, no, I do get it. I understand how important it is. And next year we're going to do better when we play Carolina." And the alumnus said, he said, "No, Coach, you're not getting it. You don't understand. If you don't beat Carolina next year, we're going to kill your dog." And Valvano said, "Look, I get your point. I don't have a dog, but I hear what you're saying. Believe me." He said he didn't have a dog. So the next morning, Jim gets up to go get his newspaper and walks to the front door and opens the door up. And on the front step is a basket. And under the blanket is the cutest little puppy you've ever seen in your life. And around the puppy's neck is a note that says, "Don't get too attached." So Jim claimed that story was true. I'm a little suspicious. Now, there are a couple, though, that I think are as funny that I know are true. One was that the first time he went to get his hair cut on the ANC State campus, he went to the barber shop, and the old barber there said to him, "You the fella replaced old Norman Sloan?" "Yes, I am." He says, "Boy, I hope you have more luck around here than old Norman did." And Valvano said, "Hang on a second. Didn't Norman Sloan win a national championship? Didn't he go 27-0 one year?" And Barbara says, "Yeah, he sure did. But just imagine what old Dean Smith could have done with that team."
So this was the atmosphere that both Valvano, the new coach at State, and the Krzyzewski, the new coach at Duke, had to deal with. And tell us how each of them responded to that challenge and when they sort of were able to make it almost.
Well, there's no question the turning point for Jim was that third year.
Tell us about the first 2 years.
Well, the first year they struggled. They were 14-13. They were a very young team. Lo Wittenberg and Bailey were sophomores. But then the second year they improved. They actually won 22 games and went to the NCAA tournament. But they lost to Tennessee Chattanooga in the first round. And as Jim always pointed out, more important, he was 0-6 against Dean at that point. And you know how State fans are about Carolina and Duke. And
so even though he was, quote, successful,
it wasn't
really
enough.
Working with people that Norm Sloan had recruited mostly, but that he was successful with one and loss in NCAA, but compared to Carolina,
Carolina
was
won
a zero.
The national championship in 82. And as I said, he was 0-6 against them. And then that third year, they lost the first time they played Carolina in Chapel Hill. Then Wittenberg broke his foot. And it was looking as if they might not make the tournament at all. And this is with three seniors, Wittenberg, Lowe, and Bailey. And a lot of the players I talked to felt that and Pam Valvano, too, that if they had not made the NCAA tournament that year, there might have been some calls for his head. Because even though people liked him, you know, he was still this Italian guy from New York City. And maybe he's not right for us here at NC State. And then in the ACC tournament, of course, they beat Wake Forest by one. They beat Carolina in overtime. Sam Perkins took a shot at the buzzer that was, everybody says, I was there. But all the guys on the court say the shot was three quarters of the way down, and it came out. And that was sort of one of those destiny type things. They win that game in overtime. They beat Virginia in the final to get into the tournament. But then they beat Pepperdine in double overtime. only because a guy named Dane Suttle, who was an 85% free throw shooter, missed the front end of 2 1-on-1s. They beat Vegas on a tip-in by Bailey at the buzzer. Then they beat Virginia when they don't throw the ball to Ralph Sampson down one. Tim Mullen takes the shot and he misses. And then, of course, the national championship game with the famous Derek Wittenberg pass, as he likes to call it, to Lorenzo Charles, and Jim making that famous run to nowhere around
which
the pit
we see over and over again.
The irony of that, I wrote this in the book, is that was the beginning of a run, a longer run to nowhere for Jim, because when they won in 83, he had always said his one goal as a coach was to cut down the final net. When he used to do clinics at the famous five-star camp, which is where Michael Jordan was first really discovered by the coaches nationally years ago. At the end of the clinic, he would always make the campers pick him up on their shoulders and he would cut down the net, which made Garfinkel crazy because he had to pay for a new net. But he was a great clinician. And when he did that, he was 37. And just to put that in a little bit of perspective, no coach under the age of 40 has won a national championship since then. And he felt his words to me, and I'm sure to others, were, I felt like I had done coaching. Krzyzewski and Smith were coaching lifers. When they won their first national championship, the next thing they thought about was winning a second national championship. When Jim won his first national championship, his first thought was, what do I do now? You know, I've done coaching. Should I become a comedian? Should I be on TV? Should I sell blue jeans, which he did for a while?
Well, he did all of that.
He did everything. I mean, he would fly on Sunday night up to New York and do the CBS morning show Monday morning and then fly back in time for practice. He would coach a game on Saturday and then fly somewhere and do color on NBC on Sunday. And later on, he admitted he wasn't paying enough attention to his program.
In terms of the rivalry or the looking for equality, did Jim Valvano feel like he won the national championship? He was then in the league with
League, but I don't think he ever felt he was his equal. I mean, Dean had accomplished far too much. By that point, Dean had been to 7 Final Fours and won a national championship and coached an Olympic gold medal winning team in 76. But winning in 83 made Jim into a rock star because his personality was so different than Dean's. If Dean had never done an interview in his 36 years at Carolina, he'd have been very happy. And Jim was, you know, I would sit with Jim at 3 o'clock in the morning in his office and he would stretch out on his couch and he would say, you're my psychiatrist. And then he would talk and he would say, what am I going to be when I grow up? And go on and on and on. It was fascinating. It was funny. But can you imagine Dean Smith doing that with anybody? Of course not. So they were very different characters. But Jim became a rock star. And because he was so popular, they were able to get in the homes of kids they couldn't have gotten into with earlier. And so he kept getting good players. The problem was he wasn't paying enough attention to who those players were. And some of them were real academic risks. And that's what, at least in part, led to the downfall eventually. Krzyzewski, it was a little different because it took him longer.
Talk about Krzyzewski's first 2 years. I think we forget about that.
First three, yeah.
In terms of the real, can you even go back in this case to why Krzyzewski even got it?
It's a remarkable story, actually. I'm glad you asked, because when Bill Foster and Norman Sloan were both very successful coaches at Duke and at NC State, and they both left largely because of the aura of Dean. They just felt no matter what they did, they would always be in Dean's shadow.
You mentioned other things in terms of their relationship, their feeling for support on their campuses.
Right, and a lot of it came from, you know, Bill Foster used to say all the time, I thought it was Naismith who invented basketball, not Dean Smith.
Mm-hmm. Well, you even mentioned like at Duke that people said Foster left because he couldn't get his parking lot paved.
Well, that became legend, that the parking lot hadn't gotten paved and that was why he left. Foster saw that as symbolic of him not being appreciated for turning the program around, which he did. They played the national championship game in 78 by Tom Butters. And he and Butters, in the end, did not get along at all. And it was a mutual parting by the time it happened. But for two coaches that successful in the ACC, which was, you know, coaching Mecca, to leave at the same time was actually quite remarkable. And when Foster left, Tom Butters put Steve Vasendak, who'd been a great player at Duke in the 60s and was an associate AD in charge of the search, said, bring me names. And Vasendak had met Krzyzewski at Army. He was working for Converse, and he lived in Annapolis. He went to spend some time with Krzyzewski on a day when they were in town playing Navy. And he was blown away by him, by how organized he was, how he communicated with his players, and it stayed in his mind. So when he sat down with Butters to talk about coaching candidates, he brought up the name Mike Krzyzewski. And Butters looked at him and said, who? He had no idea who he was. Had never
heard the
name.
Did he check his record at Army?
Well, yes, he did. And Butter said, tell me about him. So he told him, you know, the guy's a tremendous defensive coach. He's young. We want young. And he said, well, he's at Army. How'd he do this year? And Vicente said, well, he went 9-17. And Butter said, you want me to hire a guy who was 9-17 at Army? Are you trying to get my job? But he agreed. He called Bob Knight. And interestingly, because everybody always gives Knight credit for Krzyzewski getting the job, according to Butters, he said, I'm looking for a new coach. Who do you recommend? And Knight said, Dave Bliss, who's at Oklahoma. And he said, yeah, I know about Bliss. Anybody else? He said, Don DeVoe, who was at Tennessee. And he says, yep, he's a fine coach. Anybody else? He says, yes, Bob Weltlich, great defensive coach who was at Mississippi. So Butters finally said, what about this young guy at Army, Mike Krzyzewski? And there was a long pause, according to Butters. And finally, Knight said, Butters, you like how I coach, don't you? And Tom said, yes, I do. And he said, Mike Krzyzewski has all my good qualities and none of my bad, which was a great description, if you think about it, in retrospect. And that stuck with Butters, and then he decided to interview him. And once he interviewed him, he couldn't get him out of his mind because he was so impressed with him. And he kept saying, I can't hire him. He was 9-17 at Army. He interviewed him three times. After the third interview, which was at Duke, he sent him back to the airport, and Vicendak went in and said, well, he said, I think he's the next great coach. And Vicendak said, so you hired him? He said, no, I can't hire a guy who was 9-17 at Army. And Vicendak said, if he's the next great coach, Tom, how can you not hire him? And Butters said, go get him. And Vicendak had to go pull him off the plane at Raleigh-Durham Airport to bring him back to Duke to be offered the job.
And what was the salary like?
$40,000 a year for 5 years. And Krzyzewski tells a story that when he accepted the job, Butters said, don't you want to know how much I'll pay you? And he said, oh, I'm sure you'll be fair. And the way Mike tells the story, he said, and he wasn't.
he was fair, but he wasn't.
Yeah, and then
what was it?
24 years later, Mike was offered $40 million for 5 years to coach the Lakers. And he called Butters. He said, I've been offered $40 million for 5 years. What do you think? And Butters said, I think you should send me a 10% finder's fee. And Krzyzewski said, fine, I'll send you $4,000.
We're visiting with John Feinstein. We're talking about his new book, The Legends Club. Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and an epic college basketball rivalry. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with John Feinstein about his new book, The Legends Club, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and the epic and an epic college basketball rivalry. It is epic. When did Duke? We mentioned that Krzyzewski had not a very great
first
record,
3 years, right?
Record at Army. And I was just going to ask you, did he come in and immediately show that he was a great coach at Duke?
No, actually, his record at Army overall wasn't bad. He was 73-59 in 5 years, which for Army is pretty good. In fact, Army has not been to a postseason tournament since he was there, and he left in 1980, so that tells you a lot. But his first year, they were decent because they still had Gene Banks and Kenny Dennard left from the 1978 Final Four team. They did beat Carolina in Cameron. Gene Banks made a 25-footer at the buzzer over Sam Perkins' 7-foot-9-inch long arms, and Duke won in overtime. There's a funny story about that day. Linnea Smith had just given birth 2 days earlier to her and Dean's second child, a daughter, and she was in a hospital in Durham. Linnea says, you know, my girls have to live with the fact that they were born in Durham because her doctor was in Durham, and she was in the hospital. She'd had a C-section, so she'd had to stay for a couple days, and she's watching the game on TV. Dean was going to pick her up after the game on the way home and take she and Kristen home, and so she's watching the game, and she said she had all these birth hormones raging, and every time Duke scored a basket, she would go, no, no, my daughter's life's going to be ruined if we lose this game. And finally, Banks makes the shot, and Duke ends up winning the game, and she's just distraught. And Dean picked her up, and she said there was not a word spoken on the way home to Chapel Hill because he was so upset. He hated losing at Duke.
She's coming home. The baby's coming home.
Yes,
and
yes.
They're just
not a word. And she and Dean, because as you know, Linnea is a doctor. She's a psychologist, and they used to have talks about how the importance of winning and losing. And they finally agreed that winning and losing wasn't life and death, but it was very serious. And that same night, according to Mickey Krzyzewski, during the celebration of the win.
So the Duke people were happy and things were going on over
there. Things were great. And
Nine months later,
according to Mickey, their third child was conceived that night. And she said it could only have been that night. And, Coach, this is another thing.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, John, but this is the great story. But your whole book tells us what a strenuous, strained family life a coach naturally has.
Yes.
And so this story, which is great, and I'm sorry I interrupted it, but it shows in both cases what extraordinary challenges there are to family life for the coaches.
Yeah, I mean, there's an old saying that the wives suffer more. Coaching wives. And there's something to that, I really believe, because they are just as involved. It's just as important to them, but they have no control because their husband ultimately has to be the one who coaches the team.
Well, go ahead and tell. I apologize.
No,
tell the rest of the story.
Jamie Krzyzewski was born 9 months later. And 8 or 9 years later, Dean Smith, Linnea Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, and Mickey Krzyzewski are all sitting together at their two daughters' piano recitals because they took piano lessons from the same teacher. And that, again, that's what's unique about this rivalry, that they live so close. They live in the same community. And Duke people and Carolina people and State people interact all the time. Ohio State and Michigan people don't interact every single day of their lives. It's not like that in other rivalries. But it is funny how that, as Linnea said, that one game so affected both their lives.
I love that storyline. But the part that kind of was left unspoken was whether or not at this point, now this is 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, 9 years later, from that time when the famous handshake or grab shake.
Right,
that,
infamous.
Which was kind of mean.
Yeah.
Whether or not at the piano recital, all of that disappeared and they were respectful and friends.
Yeah, I don't know about friends, but I think at that point there was certainly respect because by then Duke was pretty good and Carolina, of course, was still great. And certainly there was civility, but I don't think at that point they had reached the stage where they each understood one another. I think I witnessed the moment when the relationship changed.
You did.
I really do believe that. 1997, I was doing a book on the ACC and spending time with all the coaches and all the teams.
Now, this was the year Dean retired.
It was Dean's last year. Mm-hmm. And they played in Cameron, and both teams had struggled out of the gate. Actually, they weren't ranked. It looked like the powers in the ACC that year were going to be Wake Forest, which had Tim Duncan, and Clemson, and Maryland. And so they're playing in Cameron, and I think Carolina at that point was 3-4 in the conference, and Duke was 4-3, so atypical. But it was a great game. It was a classic Duke-Carolina game, and Jeff Capel, who was a senior, hit a shot near the end, and Duke ended up winning a very close game. And I was standing there when the two coaches shook hands while all hell was breaking loose around us because the students were storming the court because Duke hadn't beaten Carolina for 4 years. And Dean says to Mike, he says, you know, that was a great game. And he said, I feel good because my guys gave your guys everything they had and your guys needed everything they had to win the game. And Mike said back, I think this game will make us both better. Which turned out to be true. Carolina didn't lose again until the Final Four, and Duke won the ACC regular season title. And at that moment, they each tapped each other on the chest.
That was the first tap.
Yeah, that was
the tap moment.
Yeah, and I remember thinking, because I always had great respect for both of them.
So how did you happen to be so close?
Because I was working on this book, and
on the ACC book.
March to Madness, and I was sitting at the scorer's table next to the Duke bench because the game was at Duke. And when the game ended, I was literally a half step behind Krzyzewski as he and Dean shook hands and tried to stay as close as I could because I wanted to hear if they said anything to one another and was fortunate to have the opportunity to do that. And I think certainly after Dean retired, and as I said, when Mike became Dean, the respect level grew to the point where the moment I got the idea for this book, really, it was in September of 2013. I was at a dinner where Krzyzewski was being given another coaching award, and we were sitting together, and he was telling me about having seen Dean the month before down at Figure Eight, where they both had houses. And he was very sad because by then Dean was in the last stages of dementia, and he said that he and Mickey had gone to visit, and Linnea had warned them before they came over, you know, you're welcome to come, but he may not even know you're in the room. But if you want to see him, please come over. And so they went over. They walked down the beach and went over to the house. And Dean was in a wheelchair, and he was kind of staring into space. And Mike was trying to talk to him because Mike, being a military guy, believes in mind over matter. You know, you can if you want to make something happen, you can will it to happen. And so he was saying to him, I'm so proud of you for winning the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Nobody's ever deserved it more. And you've been such a – you've done so much for coaching and for basketball and for the players that you coach. And he's going on like that. And Dean still nothing. And finally Mike went over because as Mickey said that Mickey was about to burst into tears because this was so sad to see this guy who had the greatest mind of anybody you ever met in this condition.
And the greatest memory.
The greatest memory ever. I mean, I have a pretty good memory. But Dean's was beyond belief. I mean, I always tell people when I would come down here and I would see Dean, he would never say, how are your children? He would say, how are Danny and Bridget? Mm. And he did that for everybody. He was amazing that way. And so finally Mike went over and he leaned down and he took Dean's hand in a handshake and formed it into a handshake. And he put his left hand on his shoulder and he said, Coach, I love you. And he said, Dean looked up at him. And he saw recognition in his eyes, and he thought he saw recognition in his eyes. And then a moment later, Dean took his left hand, put it on Mike's right hand, and squeezed. And Mike said that that meant so much to him, you know, that there was some recognition even at that point. But it made him very sad at the same time. And I thought, that's amazing when you think about the first handshake and the hostility
to
the last handshake. And that's really at the moment when I said, this was an extraordinary relationship. And Mike and Jim, we know, had an extraordinary relationship because the last few months of Jim's life, Mike visited him in the hospital every single night. He was at Duke Hospital. And he would walk across the campus and after practice, and he would go visit him. And Pam Valvano would literally take her daughters, and they would leave the room so Mike and Jim could be alone together. And Mike would spend an hour or so. And what Pam said was, during that hour— or however long it was, Jim didn't have cancer anymore. He was a basketball coach again. He was with a peer. He was with a friend. He was with someone who was the father of three daughters, just like he was, someone his age, someone who knew what it was like to compete at the top level and succeed. And she said, John Saunders, who was very close to Jim, said that it was as if Mike was an angel sent by God to help Jim get through this. But Mike will tell you that it meant every bit as much to him as it did to Jim. He said, because sometimes when you do something just because it's the right thing, you get more out of it than the person you're supposedly trying to help.
There's a slogan in there in your book.
Yeah.
Don't be too proud to do the right thing.
Dean. Yeah. That was Dean's comment to me in 1981 when I first found out that he had helped desegregate restaurants in Chapel Hill. Reverend Seymour had told me the story. And when I went to ask Dean about it, he said to me, who told you that? And I said, well, Reverend Seymour. He said, well, I wish he hadn't told you that. And I said, why, Dean? You should be proud of doing something like that. He said, John, you should never be proud of doing the right thing. You should just do the right thing. And he very much lived his life that way.
We're visiting with John Feinstein. We're visiting with him in connection with the launch of his new book, The Legends Club, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and an epic college basketball rivalry. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with John Feinstein. We've been talking about his book, The Legends Club, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski. You say that. I can't say the whole thing.
The Legends Club, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and an epic college basketball
rivalry. How did I get a copy
of
this book?
You said, and the epic college basketball rivalry. And you know what? You might be right. Maybe that should have been the title because it was the epic college basketball rivalry.
It's funny. You go across the country and other people have – we hear – this is our temple. These are our gods, and we think they should be everybody's gods.
You know what? I think that all three of them, in different ways, have reached a point where they are national figures. Mm-hmm. I mean, very much national figures. If you, as I said earlier, if you put together the Mount Rushmore of coaches, it has to be Wooden, Knight, Dean, and Mike. You pick your order. I don't care, but they're the four. And Valvano, as I said, has this unique niche. Because
he's got his own mountain.
he does, Valvano Mountain, right. And because not only because he won that championship in 83 in such an extraordinary way, but because of what he did the last year of his life when he was dealing with cancer. And he's a different kind of icon than the other two are. But they're all icons. And the way to get the book, to answer your question, is go into any bookstore. And if it's not there and well displayed, yell at them. But it's also available online, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or at my website. If you go to jfeinsteinbooks.com, there's a link there.
Well, you were complaining when you came in that your arm was tired, your left hand was tired from signing books.
Yeah.
I think you'd been at Flyleaf Books, and they were like, almost 300 books you had to sign.
Yeah. Last night, we're taping this Thursday. On Wednesday night, I went to Quail Ridge, and then I went to Flyleaf on Thursday. I'm going to Flyleaf tonight. Apparently, they've sold quite a few books there. But I had shoulder surgery 10 years ago on my left shoulder because I still try to swim, which is pretty foolish. And when I have to sign a lot, my shoulder gets sore. And I signed almost 300 books last night, which I was thrilled that people wanted them. They ran out of books. But I needed a massage when I got home.
Most of the authors I talked to would be very happy.
I'm not complaining.
To have
really
250 books total sold in their fucking.
I'm not complaining.
No, that's great. And I think lots of folks here in Chapel Hill want to read it. And part of it is because it's an insight into, particularly into Dean Smith's life.
Mm-hmm.
And
I hope.
In your book, Mike Krzyzewski is the only survivor, but
right.
You bring Roy Williams into the book, mm-hmm. as the successor, and you describe the whole transformation transformation, I guess, of the basketball program from Dean Smith
right.
to Guthridge to
Matt Daugherty to Roy.
And that
yeah.
story is one which happened to us, but we have a hard time seeing. It was like a whirlwind.
It really was, because Dean had always said that he, you know, it's funny, when I did that book I mentioned earlier on the ACC, March to Madness, during our last interview in April after that season, I said to Dean, will you coach next year? Because he'd expressed some frustration during the season with some of the players and had not enjoyed the 96 season when they weren't very good and lost in the second round to Texas Tech badly. And he said, I can't answer that. He said, I'll know in October. I'm tired now. I'm 66. I liked coaching this team, the 97 team, but I don't know. And in the back of my mind, and I actually wrote the book this way, which turned out to be good for me, I wasn't sure he was going to coach. Mm-hmm. And when the book was coming out in November.
And but it was a surprise, I think, to most of the rest of us.
I think it was. I think, and you know, of course, when it's one of those deals where it may not be a shock, but you're still surprised. And he announced it on October 10th, just before practice started, which is what he always said he would do. He wanted Bill to have the shot to coach the team. Bill went to two Final Fours in 3 years. And I think people here were saying, yeah, but when is Roy coming back? And Bill retired, and then Roy didn't come back. He stayed at Kansas, and you know, they went. Larry Brown didn't take the job, and Eddie Fogler didn't take the job, and Matt Daugherty ended up taking it with only 1 year's experience as a head coach, and it was probably a little too much for him, and lasted 3 years. They got better that third year, and he recruited Sean May, Raymond Felton, and Rashad McCants, who were key guys on the 2005 championship team. But then Roy came in, and Roy will tell you that everything Dean Smith ever did, he's tried to do.
I heard the story. You tell me what. If I missed this in your book, I'm really sorry. But the story was that after Roy won the championship, they said, "Gosh, what if Daugherty were here? What would you do?" And he said, "I would kiss him
for
those three players."
Right, right.
And he was appreciative of what other people had done when everybody else was down on Matt.
You know, one of the things it was important to Dean. Dean wasn't happy with some of the things Matt Daugherty did when he was here. Got rid of some of the office staff that had been around for a long time, and insisted on bringing his coaches from Notre Dame, which was understandable. They'd only been there a year, but that meant guys like Phil Ford and Pat Sullivan and Dave Hanners.
Out of work. Really mad about that.
But Dean didn't want the family, as he would call it, to fall apart over this. And he made a very concerted effort to say to people like Roy and others, he's still one of us. And don't ever forget that. Matt Daugherty's still one of us. So it didn't surprise me when Roy made a point publicly of saying, hey, folks, these three guys are one of the main reasons we won this national championship.
Well, what are you going to do next? This book is phenomenal.
Well, and it was a lot of fun. It was a labor of love for me because I knew all three of them so well. And so I've said to others, I wasn't born to write this book, but I lived it. I mean, I was covering them during the 80s and 90s a lot and spent a lot of time with all three of them. But I'm actually starting work now on a book on the Ryder Cup this coming year.
So you're going to go back to golf?
Go back to golf, yes.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it a different set of fans? I mean, we talked to Ron Stutz, who loves all your books.
Right.
But there are crossovers.
There are crossovers. There are people. I mean, I'm very lucky. After 36 books, there are people who tell me that they'll buy anything that I write, and the more of that, the merrier. But there are also people. It's funny because when I'm at golf tournaments, people will say, When are you going to write another golf book? I know you write those basketball books, but when are you going to write another golf book? And of course, when I'm at basketball events, they say, don't waste your time with golf. You know, you focus on basketball. So it's kind of a nice problem to have.
That's a great problem to have. But we want to keep on nudging you in the basketball. Thank you for this great story.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun.
And we hope you'll come back. Even if you bring a golf book, we would love for you to come back.
Invite me back and I'll be here. Thanks.
Thanks. My guest has been John Feinstein, author of The Legends Club. Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and the epic college basketball rivalry. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.